From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. There was more violence today in Afghanistan with a series of explosions reported in the eastern city of Jalalabad. This follows Saturday's attack on a wedding party in the capital of Kabul that left more than 60 people dead and nearly 200 others wounded. All of this violence comes as the United States is in peace talks with the Taliban to end the war that started back in 2001. The BBC's Dawood Azami joins us from London. Dawood, ISIS claimed responsibility for the wedding party attack. What does this tell us?
It tells us that the conflict is becoming deadlier and even wedding halls are not safe anymore, because in the past, as you know, Afghanistan has been in war for decades. This is almost 40 years that the conflict has been going on. But there were certain no-go areas like mosques, funerals, wedding parties. But such attacks show that even those places are not safe anymore. And it also shows about the overall strategy of the U.S. and the Afghan government, that they couldn't secure the country after fighting the Taliban and other groups for almost 18 years. So that's the reason that the U.S. is now talking to the Taliban. But even if there is peace with the Taliban, groups like ISIS might still be trying to find a way to carry out attacks. But I'm sure violence wouldn't be on this scale. But there will be small pockets of groups like ISIS that will be trying to carry out violence.
Everyone's talking about the timing of this. Do you think that this has anything to do with the peace talks that the Taliban is involved with the U.S.?
When it comes to the conflict in Afghanistan, everything is linked to the other, because it is so complicated and there are so many players. So Taliban and the U.S.-backed Afghan government, they are the main sides of this conflict. But then there are other agendas, groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda. Then there are regional groups like the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, the Islamic Jihad Union, and then regional players like Pakistan and Iran. So they all have their own goals and agendas. So that's why it is very complicated and difficult to resolve. But there is hope now that the U.S.-Taliban talks will eventually lead to peace, because this is the first time in the past 18 years that almost all state actors, plus the Taliban, are on the same page, meaning that they want to resolve this conflict through talks. And everyone says that there is no military solution to the conflict in Afghanistan. So there's the only hope for the ordinary people. Otherwise, they are caught in the crossfire. So it is that complicated now, because violence is intensifying. Afghanistan was never so insecure in the past 18 years as it is now.
What is the realistic outcome of the peace talks between the U.S. and the Taliban, also considering that the Afghan government isn't involved in these talks?
Well, this is the first time in the past 18 years that all the major players, including the Taliban, are on the same page, and they are saying that the war is not the solution. We want to resolve this conflict through talks, through peaceful means. And that's why the U.S. and Taliban are now talking to each other for almost a year now. And then in the next phase, when the U.S. and the Taliban have an agreement, in the next phase, the Afghan government and the Taliban will sit with each other. So they are still in phase one, and the U.S. and Taliban are very close to an agreement. It is hoped that in the next few days or weeks, they will announce an agreement. And then the peace process will enter into the second phase, in which the Afghan government and Taliban will talk to each other and possibly agree to some sort of settlement. But that will be more difficult and more complicated, I think, than the first phase. Because in the first phase, there were mainly two parties, the Taliban and the American government. But in the second phase, when it comes to the Taliban, then the Afghan government, then the civil society, then the political parties, then the regional players. So that's why it will be more complicated, I think. But at least this will be the start of an intra-Afghan dialogue which hasn't happened in the past. So there are hopes that ordinary people have in Afghanistan that, yes, we can tolerate this, but if there is light at the end of the tunnel.
The BBC's Dawood Azami, speaking with us from London. Dawood, thank you.
You are welcome.
Well, here in the U.S., President Trump is trying to calm fears that the economy is headed for a downturn.
I don't think we're having a recession. We're doing tremendously well. Our consumers are rich. I gave a tremendous tax cut, and they're loaded up with money.
That was the president speaking yesterday, and his advisors are busy hammering home the same message. Here's Kellyanne Conway today on Fox News.
Look, the fundamentals are very strong. We know that more people are working now than ever before in American history, more people off of the sidelines back into the workforce.
But many economists say despite the low unemployment, there are signs of a coming recession. NPR's Jim Zaroli joins us now. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Last week was a wild one on Wall Street. At one point, the Dow fell 800 points, and now it appears to be a very coordinated effort from the White House making the rounds on cable news to say, look, don't worry, the economy is fine. Does it sound like they're worried to you?
Well, I think they're really trying to push back against some of the anxious commentary we've been seeing lately, especially because of the stock market being so volatile. And, you know, they're certainly correct that we are not in a recession. Most economists right now don't even really think the recession is on the horizon. But the odds have gone up, and that's mainly because of two things. First, other countries are slowing down, especially in Europe, and that affects the United States inevitably at some point. The other big factor that makes a recession more likely is the trade war. Our trade policy with China is very erratic. You know, one day the Trump administration says it's imposing tariffs on Chinese imports. Then it says, well, we won't do it until December. So I think just businesses find this kind of environment, this uncertainty, very difficult to deal with. And we've seen business investment really go down. Companies aren't willing to put money into stuff like factories and equipment because they don't know what to expect.
The administration is also making the point, as we heard Kellyanne Conway say there, that the fundamentals of the economy are strong. In fact, unemployment is very low and consumer spending is still pretty strong. So, you know, how important are those indicators related to other ones that might predict a recession?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a paradox right now. We're seeing businesses really concerned about the direction of the economy, and that is hurting stocks. But the concern isn't filtering down to, you know, ordinary people. They are still out there buying, and that's probably because the job market remains strong, which is important because consumers are most of the economy. They provide 70% of economic growth in the country. But companies are worried about where the economy is going. They haven't been laying people off, which is important. If that happens, we're just in a much more dangerous territory. And of course, it increases the risk of a recession.
You mentioned trade. And over the weekend, White House trade advisor Peter Navarro said that U.S. tariffs on China are not hurting U.S. consumers. Again, even though last week the administration delayed the latest round of tariffs ahead of the Christmas shopping season. And there was also this study from researchers at Harvard and the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, among other high-profile economists, who found that U.S. importers are, in fact, carrying nearly all of the burden of those tariffs. What is true about those tariffs and the impact they're having on consumers?
Yeah, I mean, over and over again, the president has said these tariffs are paid for by China. He said it again yesterday. Over and over again, he's wrong. He's been wrong. Tariffs are paid for by importers when they bring products from other countries into the ports in the U.S. to sell them here. They have to pay a tariff. Now, sometimes they can be absorbed by, you know, at the other end by the manufacturers in China. Which saves the importers maybe some money. But the more they rise, the more they threaten to mean higher prices. And at the end of the day, that will hurt consumers.
Do you think the president then was being disingenuous by saying that this was, you know, just a gift for the Christmas shopping season? It doesn't really harm consumers.
Yeah, it was kind of puzzling because on the one hand, he says consumers aren't being harmed by this, that China is paying, that we're actually making money off the tariffs. And on the other hand, he says, well, we will to spare consumers higher prices at Christmas time, the holiday shopping season, we will delay them until December 15th. So there's kind of a paradox there.
Sure. And Jim, the bigger context here, of course, this is going to be an election year. And the president doesn't want to go into 2020 in the campaign season with an economy that does not look good. So clearly, that's why he's blaming the media, and that's why he's blaming the Fed for the way the economy is looking right now. But can the president effectively avoid blame for the economy?
Well, I mean, the president has taken a lot of credit for the economy, you know, since he was inaugurated. And of course, he will be blamed if the economy is not doing well. How much he will be blamed, how much he will be hurt by that politically depends on how severe the recession is and how long it is. But you know, he's certainly defied predictions before.
NPR's Jim Zarroli, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
This weekend, police in three states arrested men they suspect were planning mass shootings. This comes as momentum builds for the federal government and law enforcement to crack down on white supremacist violence and threats of violence. After the El Paso massacre, Texas Governor Greg Abbott says he's forming a task force to proactively seek, assess, and monitor domestic terrorism threats. And President Trump has said he will give the FBI whatever it needs to combat domestic terrorism. But what does it mean to seek, assess, and monitor? How are the FBI's resources currently being used in this effort? Faiza Patel is co-director of the Brennan Center for Liberty and National Security. She's also testified before Congress opposing the dragnet surveillance of Muslims. Faiza, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we start, can you clarify for us the current federal laws on the books for fighting domestic terrorism?
So there are a number of laws on the books that can be used to prosecute somebody for domestic terrorism. We've cataloged at the Brennan Center 52 separate laws that can be used to prosecute domestic terrorists. In addition, there are five federal hate crimes laws. States have their own hate crimes laws for the most part. And the federal government also has access to broad conspiracy statutes where more than one person is involved in carrying out an act of violence. So there's a range of laws that can be used to prosecute domestic terrorism. In addition, I think one of the main issues is about how you investigate domestic terrorism and how do you monitor it and how do you keep track of it. And I think there's a couple of issues over there that are really important to clarify. So the one is that since 9/11, the FBI has been given very broad authority to carry out investigations even when it doesn't have suspicion of criminal activity. It needs only to have an authorized purpose, and surely preventing violence by somebody who wants to shoot up a synagogue or a mosque or, I guess, a Walmart is plenty of authorized purpose for the FBI to investigate. And the FBI has used this authority very aggressively when it came to disrupting Al-Qaeda, ISIS type of plots, and some would say even too aggressively.
You mentioned all of the foundational laws that are already in place to help in fighting domestic terrorism. So your argument is that the FBI should not beef up its resources, but use the resources that are already in place. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So the FBI has some, from our last statistics that we have, has some, you know, 2,000 plus agents assigned to counterterrorism. And of those agents, around 300, based on the last numbers we have, are assigned to look at domestic terrorism. And so that tells you how much priority the FBI has historically given to domestic terrorism. The second thing that's really relevant to this conversation is the priorities that the FBI assigns. So the FBI's number one mission, priority mission, is counterterrorism. But most domestic terrorism, particularly the white nationalist variety, gets treated as hate crimes, and that's prosecuted as a civil rights violation, which is number five on the FBI's list of priorities. So given that we've seen this apparent surge of right-wing violence over the last few years, I think it's really important for the FBI to recalibrate the resources that it already has and to make a really objective assessment of the risks that we as a nation face and where it should be spending its money and its personnel. You know, one of the things that's really, really important when we talk about domestic terrorism is to realize that when the FBI uses the term domestic terrorism, it's referring to a range of different kinds of violent acts, right? It's not just white nationalists. It's also environmental groups who are often prosecuted for property crimes. It's also, you know, most recently the FBI identified black identity extremists as a potential terrorist group, which is basically another way of going after Black Lives Matter activists. And so it really is, I think, reflecting the FBI's sort of traditional hostility towards social protest movements such as the Black Lives Matter movement. So these are the kinds of things that can get hidden under a term like domestic terrorism, and people think the FBI is doing something about white nationalism, but actually it's pursuing potentially a different agenda.
Right now, everyone is talking about gun control, and oftentimes surveillance is put up against gun control. So either surveillance or gun control. Do you think there needs to be a choice made?
I think that extended surveillance is often proposed as an alternative to gun control because people don't want to do gun control. It's too hard. You know, you have a very strong gun lobby. And so surveillance seems like an easier lift. But I think it's really important to recognize that there needs to be a lot of balance and limits when we're talking about surveillance, because surveillance can very quickly get out of hand. Surveillance authorities are exercised in secret for the most part, and they have, you know, really significant costs on a free society and our ability to speak and our ability to organize and our ability to associate. So I don't think surveillance should be increased in lieu of gun control or because we're too chicken to gun control, basically. But I do think that when you do have surveillance, and it is appropriate in many instances, it needs to be quite defined and limited, and there need to be pretty significant controls on how it's conducted.
Faiza Patel, co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Thanks for joining us, Faiza.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Law enforcement officials across the country use a digital map to keep track of drug overdoses and track down drug dealers. Now, a paramedic in Hartford, Connecticut, has come up with a different approach. Cassandra Basler from member station WSHU explains how this paramedic's efforts to save lives in real time led to a statewide program.
Paramedic Peter Canning walks me through Hartford's Pope Park. He picks up empty heroin baggies as we pass athletic fields, a public pool, and a picnic pavilion where a few people appear to nod off.
The pavilion place is really the place to go, but as you can see, the people are down there using right now, so we'll leave them in peace.
Canning has found overdose victims unresponsive in the bushes, porta potties, and on the bench we sit down on. He started to notice a disturbing trend about 5 years ago. He felt like every call he responded to was an overdose, and it gave him an idea.
I started just like writing down, you know, the overdoses I did, how old the people were, their gender, how they got started, and then the heroin bags I would write whether or not I saw heroin bags there. And then I thought, you know, if I'm keeping this information, which is really interesting, what if everybody was keeping this information?
But he didn't know how to put his idea into practice until he went to a conference about the opioid crisis. There, Canning ran into the interim director of the State Poison Control Center.
And he said, you know, poison control, we have operators there 24/7, and this is right up our alley.
So Canning and Poison Control launched a pilot program for a section of Hartford. Connecticut's Department of Public Health took notice. It offered federal funding to expand the program and issue monthly reports. Now, Poison Control will track all of the overdoses all in one place for the first time. Before this, some hospitals only required EMS to report when they administered the overdose antidote, naloxone. Now, every EMS worker must call a hotline after any suspected overdose under the Statewide Opioid Reporting Directive, or SWORD. And the training is a simple 12-minute video.
How to place the call. The EMS crew should call Connecticut Poison Control at 1-800-222-1222 and say, I have a call for Connecticut SWORD.
Then a certified poison specialist like Lori Salinger picks up the phone. Normally, Salinger answers calls from worried parents whose kids swallowed something they shouldn't have. With this program, Salinger asks EMS 10 questions about the overdose and writes down what happened. EMS can move on to the next emergency call after that, but Salinger continues to track the patient.
Poison control.
She calls a hospital to check up on an overdose victim and explains the new protocol to someone on the line.
And so when they get transported to an emergency room, we follow up for data regarding that to help trend it. Yeah. So how's he doing?
Salinger enters patient data onto a spreadsheet as she chats on the phone. She says her office handles about 8 overdose calls a day just for the Hartford area. Poison Control has a grant to hire more specialists to man the phones as the program goes statewide. Activists who work with heroin users say these rapid overdose reports save lives. Mark Jenkins leads the Greater Hartford Harm Reduction Coalition. He pulls up an old email from paramedic Peter Canning about a rash of 11 overdoses over 2 days this past May. It even includes pictures of street drug baggies branded with logos for different types of heroin.
These ODs were all separate incidents. One was fatal, and the identified bags included Pray for Death, I'll Be Back, and Head Games. 3 ODs were on Park Street in the Frog Hollow section.
Jenkins says the email came out fast enough for him to send street teams there to hand out naloxone kits and strips to test for fentanyl. That's a synthetic opioid 50 times more powerful than heroin.
When we get information like this, it's a heads up to say, watch out for this particular bag. Make sure you don't use alone. And if you do use together, don't use at the same time.
Jenkins wants to use data from the statewide opioid reporting directive to make the case for more funds for naloxone and other life-saving resources. Advocates and state leaders want to help curb the opioid epidemic. To do that, they need a detailed picture of what's going on. For Here and Now, I'm Cassandra Basler.
The yield curve has inverted. In the past, this has been an indicator that a recession is on its way. But will this time be different? Listen to The Indicator from Planet Money, NPR's daily economics podcast, to find out.
The 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo are still about a year away, but officials are already bracing themselves for dangerously hot conditions. Last week, the running portion of the women's triathlon test event had to be cut short because of extreme heat. And the Japan Times reports that more than 20 people died and 12,000 others were hospitalized for heat-related conditions in just 1 week earlier this month. Brett Larner writes the blog Japan Running News. He's in Tokyo on a Skype line. Brett, welcome. And how concerned are Olympic officials? It's always hot in Tokyo in August.
The heat is definitely a concern. So they've been, over the last few years since Tokyo got the bid, looking at various options to try to mitigate the circumstances of what they're going to have to dealing with next year.
And one of the things they're doing is moving the men and women's Olympic marathon event to 6 a.m. in the morning. And I know you recently ran the course at that time. How bad was it?
That's right. I've done that 2 years in a row now, gone out at the time that the marathons were scheduled to be held on August 2nd for the women both years and then August 9th for the men both years. Last year when I did it, the start time was still scheduled to be 7 o'clock, and it was pretty rough, especially after about 9 o'clock. The last, after 2 hours into the race, the conditions worsened dramatically. The heat went up dramatically after 9 o'clock. This year at 6 a.m. on those 2 days, the conditions were tough, but the good news was that after 2 hours into what would be the race time, after 8 o'clock, it didn't get dramatically worse. So I think the moving the start time to 6 o'clock, overall the conditions have not changed compared to what they would have had last year, but the danger that they'd be experiencing late in the race after the 2 hour mark, at the men's or women's race, has really been reduced. So the people kind of at the back of the pack in both of those races won't be suffering the really dangerous conditions that we might have seen with a 7 o'clock start.
They will still be suffering a little, though, I'm sure.
They will be suffering for sure, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at the forecast. 91 degrees Fahrenheit today, 82% humidity. Really miserable conditions for doing anything outside. So how do the athletes prepare for something like that?
Heat acclimation is a big part of it. If you train in these conditions for a period of time, your body can get used to it. You know, I've been living in Japan for quite a long time and running every day during the course of the summer. You know, by the time it's August, you can get used to it. The Olympic athletes will be doing that as well. You know, the Japanese athletes are out on the course at the time that the Olympic marathons will be held, pretty much every day running, getting used to those conditions. I think the British UK athletics recently tweeted some pictures of their race walkers training on a treadmill. basically in a high-tech sauna, the temperature and humidity perfectly controlled to simulate the kind of conditions that they'll be facing in Tokyo next year. So regular training in those kinds of conditions, whether natural or simulated, can have the effect of getting your body and your mind ready to deal with those kinds of conditions.
And just quickly, we're reading that the roadways along this route will be paved with special material to deflect the heat. Tell us about that.
A lot of particularly the east-west sections of the course, which make up roughly a quarter of the course, are more exposed to the sunlight than the north-south sections, which are largely shaded by the buildings on the east side. So primarily on those east-west sections, they've been laying down this sparkly gray coating to the pavement surface. And it's supposed to be more reflective and rather than absorbing the solar energy, be reflecting that, and that would reduce the amount of heat energy stored within the pavement. And the effect of that is supposed to decrease the temperature several degrees for the runners.
Brett Larner of Japan Running News speaking with us from Tokyo. Brett, thanks very much, and try to stay cool if you can.
Will do. Thank you.
For years now, artificial intelligence experts have been warning that algorithms, a set of rules that dictate how computers analyze data, can be biased. The rules, after all, are created by humans. But a new proposal by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, also known as HUD, could make it harder to sue banks or landlords over claims that their algorithms resulted in housing discrimination. Joining me now is Emmanuel Martinez. He's a data reporter who's covering this issue for Reveal, the Center for Investigative Reporting. Hi, Emmanuel.
Hi, Tanya. How's it going?
Can you give us a deeper understanding of this rule that HUD is now proposing?
Yeah, so the way fair lending cases are normally brought to court is through one of two ways, a disparate treatment where a lender has to explicitly show or state that they don't want to lend to people of color, and subsequently then they don't. And the other one is a little more nuanced. It is more about disparate impact, where people can show through data and through statistics that lenders treat people of color differently, that their lending patterns reveal that people of color are less likely to get a mortgage, even though they have the same financial characteristics as their white counterparts. And so these new proposed regulations really attack the second type of fair lending cases, those that rely on disparate impact, because it relaxes the way lenders are held accountable when they use algorithms that produce a bias, a disparate impact, if you will.
Your news organization, Reveal, did an award-winning series on modern-day redlining. You analyzed 31 million records. You found that in 61 cities, people of color were more likely to be denied home loans compared to their white counterparts. Can you explain how algorithmic bias came into play in these cases that you all found?
Well, for our story, we took all lenders, right? Even if it was a lender that relied on face-to-face interactions or lenders that were more based online. But more specifically, UC Berkeley did a study right after our story a few months ago that showed that discrimination is still present when lenders rely on algorithms to make their decisions. But their bias and discrimination doesn't necessarily show up in the yes-no decision of a mortgage. What UC Berkeley's study found was that lenders who rely on algorithms are charging Black and brown borrowers higher interest rates for their mortgages, even when they have the same financial characteristics as their white counterparts. So what we're seeing here is that there's discrimination in like the face-to-face level, and there's also discrimination even when you use an algorithm to make your lending decisions. Lenders can still treat people of color differently and charge them higher rates.
You spoke with an expert in this space who said this may not be a negative thing. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So the way people in the technology world are viewing it is that eliminating bias and eliminating discrimination is nearly impossible to do. And so algorithms may not necessarily eliminate all types of discrimination, eliminate all types of bias. And so these proposed regulations that don't hold lenders accountable for algorithms that produce a bias, that produce a discriminatory effect, take that into account.
This all feels confusing because HUD Secretary Ben Carson just released a statement said that this is intended to increase legal clarity and promote the production and availability of housing. in all areas, and they take instances of discrimination against people very seriously. And yet, it has already been proven that algorithmic bias is a real thing. Why do you think they're doing this?
These changes that HUD is proposing are very parallel in terms of what the Trump administration has already done in terms of housing. There are a lot of rollbacks in terms of what lenders need to report to the federal government when it comes to lending cases or lending mortgage applications. And we reported back in May how HUD was thinking about changing this disparate impact rule. So this kind of furthers that narrative of how the Trump administration is making it harder for people to access home ownership on an equal playing field.
Lawyers and civil rights organizations probably will challenge this in a big way, I'm guessing.
None of the housing advocates that we have spoken to, none of them are going to sit by. They're gearing up for a fight here because they feel that discrimination is going to get much easier and that people won't have equal access to home ownership or housing, right? And this comes at a time when the gap between Black and white home ownership is at its most widest that it's ever been.
How will this impact potentially lawsuits that are already out there that are in the courts? There's one in Connecticut, for instance. A real estate firm is being sued for allegedly using a biased algorithm as part of tenant screening services to weed out criminal records. That's now going through the courts. This could potentially change the course of that outcome of that lawsuit.
Yeah, exactly. And that's an example of a case that may no longer be brought forward to courts because of how that algorithm or the alleged way that algorithm makes its decision. And one of the variables that it takes into account is criminal records. And the people who brought that case say that in Connecticut and in the country in general is that people who have criminal records, and if that's a variable that you're assessing, well, it's going to disproportionately impact Black and brown people.
What's the next step? HUD says it's now public record and they're waiting for over 60 days for folks to be able to weigh in. And then what happens next?
Yeah, so lenders, any housing provider, any housing advocate, anyone who works in fair lending cases can go to HUD, their website, and make comments on these proposed regulations in terms of how they agree with these changes, why they don't agree with these changes. And then HUD collects all those comments, reads through them, and then proposes their changes.
Emmanuel Martinez is a data reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
After 17 years, residents of a small town in West Virginia can finally drink their tap water again. The McDowell County Public Service District has officially taken over the O'Toole water system. It was created more than five decades ago by a coal company that has since left the area. It fell into disrepair, and the water was too dangerous to drink. Mavis Brewster is general manager at the McDowell County Public Service District. And Mavis, this is a big day.
Yes, we've been very fortunate to get all the taps installed in the area, and the O'Toole system is a community water system much like what we've run into throughout the county. You have systems that were put in years ago by coal companies, and when the coal companies pulled out, there was no one to maintain those systems. So the residents are now very fortunate to be connected to the public water system.
And can you describe what was wrong with the water for so many years?
They didn't have any kind of filtering system or anything. They just basically pumped the water and chlorinated it and put it out into the system. No storage tank, no filter for the water. So you got a lot of iron, a lot of discolored water, and then, of course, outages, you know, when you had leaks or whatever. And you didn't really have personnel even to maintain the system. When those were put in originally, they helped with all the maintenance and they took care of everything for the residents. But once they leave, there's no one to maintain that. So you have to have upgrades. You have to have pumps replaced. And they were just pumping straight from the system into the lines.
If people for almost two decades have not been able to drink the tap water, what did they do? How did that affect people's daily life? I mean, you can't drink it. You can't bathe with it. You can't do a lot of things, it sounds like.
Right. And water is a very basic need. And, you know, they have to buy a lot of the drinking water. I can't imagine the expense that that would have been. And then a lot of times residents on fixed incomes are forced just to, you know, use that water, even though it's very poor quality.
We're reading that McDowell County is one of the poorest in the country. Much of the population has left over the years. As you say, coal companies, once big employers, are not what they used to be. We have heard about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, now in Newark, New Jersey. People in O'Toole, West Virginia, haven't been able to drink tap water for 17 years. I mean, does it surprise you at all that in the United States of America, that something like this is happening?
I think it is surprising. And actually, it's something that should not happen because, you know, with our country, we should be able to provide clean drinking water to everyone. I think that's a very basic need. And, you know, I'd like to see that. That's part of why the job is so important here, because we do provide quality, dependable water service to the residents in the county. And that's something that they did not have before the PSD was formed in 1990.
That's Mavis Brewster, general manager at the McDowell County Public Service District. Mavis, thank you so much.
You're welcome. You have a good day.
One of the fastest growing industries in the U.S. is something economists are calling wealth work. It includes jobs like manicurists, massage therapists, and dietitians that cater to wealthy people. Derek Thompson says this is the new servant class, and it may be bad for the economy. Derek is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us now as he does each Monday. Derek, it's good to speak with you.
Good to speak with you, too.
So according to the Labor Department, in the last 10 years or so, manicurist and pedicurist jobs have increased by 114%, massage therapists 105%, skincare specialists 93%. I guess this is the wealth work you've been referring to, but what's going on?
Let me tell you first why I was so interested in these numbers. When you think about the jobs of the future, you know, what do you think of? Maybe you think of tech jobs, you know, software, cloud services, maybe even marketing. But look at the kind of jobs that are growing so quickly today in high-income, dense cities, like manicurists and pedicurists that you named, massage therapists, skincare specialists, cooks, fitness trainers. These are all jobs that are growing between 2 times faster than the overall economy and 10 times faster. I mean, the number of manicurists in the U.S. doubled in a decade. This is remarkable, and this is a huge part of the future of work that we talk so much about. And it shows that what happens in an economy, particularly a local economy marked with high wealth and inequality, is that the jobs that grow fastest are often those that you cannot ship overseas, that you cannot replace with robots, and that high-income people demand. The wealth work that I'm speaking about are jobs that exist at the intersection of those three trends.
So who's doing these jobs? What are they getting paid? And what's the job security like?
The job security tends to be relatively low. The pay tends to be relatively low, especially given that these are jobs done in higher income areas. And I think it's really important to point out that a lot of these jobs are done by immigrants. I worked with a economist at the Brookings Institution, Mark Murrow, on these numbers. And he said that he estimated that 20% of wealth work is done by people who are not citizens, compared with less than 10% of all U.S. labor. So that means that foreign-born workers are twice as likely to do these wealth work jobs. And when you put it together, you know, it's not an altogether bad picture. It's important, I think, for, you know, wealth work to serve as a bridge for foreign workers and less skilled Americans to get a foothold in the labor force. But there may also be a dark side.
Right. So, you know, if these are new jobs that immigrants are able to get when they come to this country to get a foothold in the United States, that may be a good thing. But why are you so pessimistic about it, calling it an underclass of urban servants?
Well, the underclass remark is a reference to another piece that I quote that talked about how we're seeing the rise of a servant economy potentially. But let me tell you about the optimistic and the pessimistic read here. The optimistic read is that new jobs are good. New jobs in cities are good, and new opportunities for immigrants and low-skill Americans are great. These jobs are, you know, are fantastic for those groups of people. But they also are very clearly hotbeds for exploitation and alienation. Like the New York York City nail salon industry is notorious for flouting minimum wage laws and other labor regulations. Massage parlors across Florida have been notorious for serving as fronts for human trafficking. And that's not even going into the on-demand economy, that fleet of people who are driving Ubers or driving Lyfts or delivering food with DoorDash and Caviar, who are essentially considered not employees, even though they're working, but rather contractors. So the platforms they're working for are essentially going around the Fair Labor Standards Act. So in many ways, I think it's fantastic that you have this group of jobs that's growing quickly in rich cities, but the exploitation and alienation side is one that I don't want to forget about.
But isn't it also true that people who are getting manicures and pedicures and taking an Uber, I mean, look, these are not all the super, super rich. I mean, I think we should point that out, too.
Absolutely. The term wealth work comes from this economist David Autor's work, where he's essentially distinguishing between the growth of tech jobs and the growth of jobs that exist in that are essentially disproportionately located in wealthy cities. So wealth in wealth work doesn't apply exclusively to the people who are being served here. It's not as if the only people who ride around in Ubers and get facials are the 1%, the 0.1%. That's mm-hmm. obviously not true. But it is the case that these jobs do seem to be disproportionately located in wealthier zip codes and wealthier cities. And that is what wealth work refers to.
I want to ask you about a related story because it has to do with wealth inequality. The Business Roundtable, a powerful group of CEOs in the United States, said today that shareholder profits should no longer be the sole focus of a corporation, and says Americans deserve an economy that allows each person to succeed through hard work and creativity and to lead a life of meaning and dignity. Your thoughts on the significance of that shift from this powerful group of CEOs?
Words are cheap and labor is expensive. It's fantastic that some of the most important CEOs in the country are saying things like Americans deserve an economy where everyone can lead a life of dignity. Like, that's wonderful. At the same time, dignity does not come from the words of CEOs to the Business Roundtable. Mm-hmm. It comes from a living wage and from fair compensation. Yeah. And so I am waiting to see that happen.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.